Fourth case for argument this morning is Rychek against the Bank of America.
Good morning, Your Honors. Terry Rose Saunders on behalf of...
Ms. Saunders.
Sorry.
We let counsel get seated first.
Sorry, I'll start again. May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. The complaint in this case alleges a breach of contract and of a contract between the trustee of a custodian account and a bank, and also alleges breach of a fiduciary duty by the bank. The trustee set up a custodian account. The bank agreed to provide certain services to this account, and in return, the custodian was to pay a fee, and the fee was for the services. The fee was paid by the custodian account by the trust regularly. The bank, however, was regularly taking additional money from the trust for contract services, and this fee was taken under the guise of a sweep fee. In other words, in this case, the bank agreed to a fee. It was a contract. The parties had an agreement. The bank nonetheless took more money from the custodian account than it had a right to take under its contract. That's a breach of contract. And given the relationship between the parties in this case, it was also a breach of fiduciary duty. The case is not a fraud case. It made no difference to the claim that's alleged whether the non-disclosure of this fee was intentional or whether it was just inadvertent and an oversight. The wrong committed and the wrong that was alleged in the complaint, again, was a breach of contract, not a fraud. It does not matter.
I don't see how that takes it out of the scope of securities law. I mean, what you seem to be saying is that if my client doesn't have a good securities claim, it can't be a securities claim. And Dabbitt rejected that. There was not a good securities claim in Dabbitt, but it was still a securities claim, right? What was left out of the pleading in Dabbitt was the purchaser-seller doctrine.
Correct.
What was left out of the pleading here is a claim of scienter. And the defendant comes back and says, yeah, but this is still the normal scope of securities law, and if the plaintiff doesn't think it can prove scienter, it just loses. I mean, why isn't that the right way to understand this? We've got lots of securities doctrines that deal with self-enriching conduct in the context of securities sales. Churning doctrine is one of them. Best execution doctrine is one of them. Not revealing that you're a broker-dealer is one of them. I mean, all of these are standard securities cases, and it does seem awfully hard to think of self-enriching, undisclosed self-enriching conduct in the context of a securities sale as not a securities problem.
Your Honor, the difference here is that the conduct that's complained of was really related to a banking service. This is the taking of a fee, and it's independent from the securities transaction, whether the fee was taken from the bank account, recognize that there's an investment somewhere in the picture, but that doesn't necessarily bring it within the securities laws. This court has recognized that where you have a breach of, if you have a valid or plausible breach of contract claim, which is what is alleged in the complaint.
Yeah, but think about the hypotheticals I gave. Churning is a breach of contract. It's also securities fraud. Now, can one evade this SLUSA by filing a class action churning suit against a broker-dealer and just omitting the scienter allegation and saying, this is a breach of contract?
No, but that's not what's going on here.
How about if you have a systematic best execution claim, which also violates the contract, and you omit the scienter allegation and say, I just want to litigate breach of contract?
Well, Your Honor, in the Kurz case, of course, I think the court first looked at the situation and said there wasn't a breach of contract there. There was no contract. But the difference in this case is that the securities law also require that the non-disclosure, whatever the non-disclosure is, must be in connection with the purchase or sale. And that requirement is simply not met here.
Oh, that completely loses me. When you say that, you're just disagreeing with Naftalin. And Zandford, for that matter. But Naftalin is the key case, even though neither side cites it.
But, Your Honor, in Zandford, the difference in Zandford was that the fraud occurred within the transaction. And I think the court...
Yes, that's how you distinguish Zandford. That's why I say Naftalin is the key case. The fraud was not within the transaction in Naftalin. Naftalin involved a naked short, which was in breach of contract. But the short seller engaged in all the securities part of the transaction in a perfectly normal way in which a short sale was engaged in. But he was naked. That is, he didn't have cover.
Right.
And the Eighth Circuit said that's not a securities transaction because this is just a collateral contractual promise. Supreme Court reverses 9-0. I mean, your problem in your case is the same as the problem in Naftalin.
Your Honor, but in our case, there was a perfectly lawful securities transaction.
That's what the Eighth Circuit said in Naftalin. It's not securities fraud. Because the short sale was perfectly lawful and regular and all of that. It's just that there was a collateral contractual breach of contract.
But the breach of contract here is central to the case. It's not...
It was absolutely the core of the case in Naftalin. The Supreme Court said it is nonetheless a securities fraud.
Your Honor, I apologize to the court because neither party, you are correct, neither party really briefed the Naftalin
decision. Well, if you'd read Zandford carefully, you would have seen that it relied heavily on Naftalin. It essentially said, we just got, a variation on Naftalin.
Well, but in the Zandford case, the court did make a distinction which I believe applies in this case, which is that what happened here is closer to a theft. It's more like having, or an embezzlement, where the bank goes into your account, takes some money out, and calls it a fee, even though it's not entitled to take that fee. And if you look at the situation, and that was a distinction that was clearly recognized, I don't want to say clearly, but it was recognized by the court in Zandford as an exception as being a different situation. And all of the other elements here, including the damages that are being sought, the nature of the wrong, has nothing to do with any loss in value of the investment and has simply to do with the recovery of a fee.
Well, Zandford rejected that. And you may also remember, this is also something not emphasized in the party's brief, the Wharf against United International Holdings says that for purposes of securities law, an intentional breach of contract is fraud. And you're alleging an intentional breach of contract. That is, they knew what they were doing.
Your Honor, it's not necessarily intentional breach of contract. That was the point I think I made earlier on, that it's very possible this was an oversight.
Wasn't accidental.
Well, it's possible that it was oversight. But that's not really pertinent whether if it was not intentional, then it doesn't fall within, it's not a fraud. And it's possible in this situation that it was merely an oversight. And the same is true of the breach of fiduciary duty claim, because that again involves the fact that the bank had no right to just go and take funds for itself, funds that belong to this custodian account.
Ms. Saunders, how would you articulate the standard you think we should apply in identifying what's preempted by SLUSA and what's not?
I think that the standard this court had used was in the Brown, most recently in the Brown versus Calamus case, which if Basically, if there's a plausible claim for breach of contract and it's not likely that fraud will arise in the course of the litigation, that the claim should not be precluded by SLUSA. And in the Brown case, after the court's analysis, the court concluded that the case really could not proceed without the allegation of a misrepresentation, that it was central to the case. Whereas in this case,
an intentional misrepresentation.
In the Brown case, yes, mm-hmm. It was. There was. I see my time is up, Your Honor. But just to finish, there was.
What? We're talking. You can talk.
There was a misrepresentation about the value of the security that was purchased. They were common stock, but they relied on AMPS. And so the claim was that the court found that really what the basis of the case was that the AMPS were not permanent feature and that had been misrepresented.
Let me just ask one more question, if I could, and that is, why did you not sue under Rule 10b-5 in this case?
Your Honor, we never saw this as a securities fraud. I think that there was a contract. There was a fiduciary duty. And the way the parties, the relationship was structured, it did not seem to be a securities violation. So
you're relying on Gavin there, are you not?
Yes, we are, Your Honor.
But the problem there was timing, wasn't it? That's the only discrepancy that the Supreme Court has really recognized.
But, Your Honor, there's a question about timing here. I mean, one of the things we had requested, it's never been really clear to us exactly how this fee worked, the taking of the fee, but it was not necessarily, as we've alleged in the complaint, at the same time that an investment was made. The cash was swept out into an investment. The fee, as we've alleged in the complaint, was collected based on an average daily cumulative basis in the investment account, whether there had been investment at the same time. So there is a time issue here. It's, you know, one of the problems has been that there's not it's not clear exactly how the fee was assessed, but it wasn't on the account statement, so you don't see that there was an investment made and a fee charge, or an investment returned and a fee charge. There was just somewhere along the line there was a fee that was taken against the bank, the trustee's account. Unless the court has any further questions, I do see my time is up.
And Ms. Saunders.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Byrd.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, David Byrd speaking today for the defendant, Bank of America. The District Court's judgment is correct and should be affirmed. Congress enacted SLUSA to stop the filing of class actions under state.
That's a word.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I don't think that's a word.
Yes, the SLUSA. I'm sorry, I'm likely to make that.
Actually, you'd be even better off just saying the 1998 statute or something like that.
Very well, Your Honor.
Real English words are better than these made-up initialisms.
Yeah, I agree completely. It's a professional hazard, I'm afraid.
Especially for non-specialists. I happen to teach securities law on the side, but that isn't true of all judges one meets.
Certainly, Your Honor. The 1998 statute was enacted to stop the filing of class actions under state law based on allegations of misrepresentations and omissions of material fact and deception and manipulation in connection with the purchase or sale of covered securities, expressly including mutual funds. Plaintiff's action is the type of state law class action that Congress wished to stop, and it was properly dismissed for that reason. The plaintiff's class action accuses the bank of using cash from custodian accounts to purchase shares of mutual funds that had undisclosed payback arrangements with the custodian and that were selected by class members from a list of approved funds that the defendant allegedly controlled and decided. The complaint also accuses the bank of failing to disclose the compensation that the custodian would receive from these mutual fund transactions before the transactions were made and after the transactions were made. And it alleges that the bank collected and retained, quote-unquote, monies received from the mutual fund transactions in connection with securities transactions on class members' behalf.
So, Mr. Byrd, does the complaint, in essence, as far as you can tell, state a claim under rule or under Section 10B?
I don't believe it would state a claim properly under Section 10B, but
why not?
I believe that there would be issues about, first of all, the scienter point as well. There might also be other issues related to the precise ownership of the funds as a legal matter that might bring into consideration prudential limitations on a private cause of action under Section 10B and the Supreme Court's decision in blue chip stamps.
Well, there's no question but that the plaintiffs were purchasers, is there?
I believe that the plaintiff here is the beneficiary of a trust. The trust had a custodian account with the bank, and the allegation is that the custodian used daily cash balances to purchase mutual funds for that. Whether
so
at the end of the day,
the beneficiary, the plaintiffs are the plaintiffs represent beneficiaries of investments in securities. You have to say that, right?
I would agree with that.
So isn't scienter really the difference here?
There would be differences too if the plaintiffs are the beneficiaries but not the trustees, and there is at least some ambiguity about that in the record based on the custodian agreement, which names a different plaintiff as the trustee.
That we'll worry about that later.
Well, in any event, it goes to Your Honor's question about why they could not one of the potentially many reasons why they would not be able to bring a 10B5.
What I'm trying to get at is I mean, as you know, SLUSA, forgive me, the Act.
Yes, Your Honor.
Has been used.
Ready Aid Act.
Has been used, at least among district and circuit courts, to shelter a good deal of conduct from the only kind of litigation that can effectively remedy it. And it's a little hard. We understand that Congress didn't want securities fraud lawsuits on national market securities to go forward in state courts. But if parties want to allege only a breach of contract and don't want to take on the burden of proving scienter, it's a little hard to see why the statute should be interpreted as sheltering such breaches of contract or fiduciary duty.
The statute should not be construed as sheltering anything. The only thing it does is preclude the use of the class action device.
But we all know that as a practical matter, in many of these cases, that's the only viable mechanism.
Well, two points on that. There would be another viable mechanism if and when Congress wishes to amend the laws to provide a remedy for these parties. Congress has not done so. Congress has enacted the 1998 Act, which reflects Congress's judgment that these class actions should stop, that the Congress does not want this. The action deliberately uses broad language with broad preclusive effect subject to only certain narrow exceptions, and the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Davitt says that courts may not imply additional exceptions. The statute contains no exception.
The plaintiffs aren't asking for an exception here. They're just saying that a claim for breach of contract is not a claim for a fraudulent omission or misrepresentation.
Well, to respond to that question and to your question to Ms. Saunders about what the standard is here, the standard is that the class action is precluded whenever the statute's four elements are satisfied. Those four elements are satisfied here, and there does not create any exception for breach of contract or non-fraud type claims if, as they do here, the allegations satisfy the statutory requirements.
So you do read the statute as, in essence, protecting various kinds of wrongful conduct as long as that is not actionable under federal law?
Well, Dabbitt expressly recognizes that.
Dabbitt deals with a very narrow kind of problem, the difference between the scope of 10b and private implied rights of action under 10b-5 and the purchaser-seller requirement under blue chips. Do you read Dabbitt as you seemed in your brief to be reading Dabbitt as saying it absolutely does not matter whether federal law reaches this conduct?
It absolutely does not matter whether federal law creates a private cause of action for the plaintiffs. To go to Chief Judge Easterbrook's point earlier, which comes directly from his decision in the Kurz case, it doesn't matter whether SLUSA applies to good and bad securities law claims, and especially to bad ones.
So, well, do you think that the SEC could bring an enforcement action for the conduct that's alleged here?
I believe it could.
And what would it have to prove?
I think it would have to prove misrepresentations and omissions.
Or scienter?
I don't know if it would. It might have to prove scienter. I think I probably just got a demerit on my securities law exam from Chief Judge Easterbrook in flubbing the answer on scienter. I believe the SEC would have to prove scienter.
It depends on which subsection it uses. It's got some privileges to avoid scienter allegations that private parties don't have, but not under every subsection.
Well,
no need to go through the details.
Well,
not today, anyway.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. In short, and the timing of the actual receipt of payments, which is referenced in the plaintiff's briefing, and in Ms. Saunders' argument earlier today, we do not view as a material distinction. What the complaint alleges is a course of business, that's the phrase that's used in Zanford, that involves the purchase and sale of mutual fund shares. And the fees are part of that course of business. They cannot be separated out from the transaction. And we have many situations, as Chief Judge Easterbrook alluded to earlier, where self-enriching conduct in connection with securities transactions is found to be within the scope of federal securities laws. And I think that disposes of this case. If there are any further questions from the court, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll yield the balance of my time and respectfully request that you affirm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.